And this is the area that I've talked about that becomes known as the Celtic Fringe in Wales, Cornwall, and northern England. As far as we can tell, though, many of the British don't leave. They just stay, and they blend in with the new culture that the settlers bring with them. Over time, they adopt the speech of the newcomers. And this is why there's almost no trace left of the British language in modern English. The British simply stopped speaking British and started speaking the language that ultimately becomes English. But this seems to have taken a while. There seems to have been a long period of bilingualism, because there are many English place names that clearly are translations of British ones. Or they might be double names. For example, Breedon in Leicestershire. Breedon is made up of the British word for hill, bree, and the English word for hill, dun. So the name Breedon literally means hill hill. And I think in a way the name of this place is a record of this period of assimilation when the British and the English are living side by side, getting to know each other and kind of creating a new culture. But ultimately, of course, English wins out, not British. And I think this is a sign of the kind of attractiveness of the English culture, maybe its military dominance. It's probably something of both, and that's what the new settlers are able to exert on the British, and they create something new. But this assimilation, important as it was, is only part of the story. In the late 5th and early 6th centuries, there may have been some sort of concerted effort to push back against the new settlers. I mentioned Gildas before, the 6th century writer who recorded that rather pathetic cry for help to the Roman authorities. Gildas was a British writer, a Christian. He was writing about the history of Britain during the period of barbarian settlement. And he says that at the end of the 5th century, a great war leader emerged. He fought 12 great battles against the barbarians. The last of these battles at Mount Badon was a great victory, and it halted the advance of the barbarians for 50 years. And that is 50 years right up to the time when Gildas is writing, and Gildas is saying in his work that things are getting bad again. Now, this statement by Gildas seems to be the earliest evidence we have for the existence of the figure who later becomes known as King Arthur. It's not a lot to go on. Gildas calls this person a war leader, not a king. And in fact, the way he talks about him makes it very clear that there are other people who are kings, and this guy, this war leader, isn't a king. And he doesn't give him the name Arthur. He doesn't give him any other name either. We don't even know where Mount Badon is. Lots of people have tried to figure it out, but we really don't know. But there are some tentative hints out there that there may have been such a person, some war leader who fought successfully against the barbarians. Or at least that stories about such a person were widely circulating around the time that Gildas is writing. There's a poem written in Old Welsh early in the 7th century that describes a raid by the leader of the Gododdin. This is a tribe that lives around the area that's now Edinburgh. I'm not going to go into the details of the raid, but one reason the poem is famous is something that the poet says about one of the heroes of the battle. This is a guy named Gwarðr. First of all, you get some lyrical, over-the-top phrase about his performance in the battle. He stabbed over 300 of the finest. He slew both the center and the wings. He behaved worthily in the forefront of the most generous army. So far, so good. Then, the poet sticks the knife in. He adds, though he was no Arthur. So, you get the sense, Arthur is the standard of comparison. No one is going to match that. Now, the story takes a further step in the 9th century. You get a Welsh writer named Nennius, and he makes the connection between the person Gildas describes, the war leader who fights the 12 battles, and the person in the poem. He figures they're the same person. So he adds Arthur's name to Gildas' description of the battles that the famous war leader won. Some scholars have suggested that Nennius knew they were the same person because he had access to oral tradition that had been handed down since the late 5th century. There is even some evidence in the archaeological record that there may have indeed been sort of a 50-year halt in the advance of Germanic settlement in Britain. They're not going into new territory for about 50 years. So perhaps we have some confirmation here of the essential truth of the story. Could that halt have been caused by this war leader, who may or may not have been called Arthur? Well, let's review the evidence and assess the arguments. The facts as we know them could support the idea of a famous war leader, not a king, a famous war leader who stemmed the tide of the Germanic advance in Britain. Maybe he was even named Arthur. But there are some important cautions to keep in mind. We can't be sure that the person Gildas describes and the person mentioned in the poem are the same. We don't have any evidence about that, one way or the other. It may be that Nennius has good reason to think they're the same, but he may just have put the two texts side by side. He's got Gildas, he's got the poem, he puts the two texts side by side, and he makes a great big assumption. We also can't be sure that the pause in settlement that we seem to see in the archaeological record is caused by the activity of the war leader that Gildas mentions. There are plenty of other factors that might have caused a temporary halt in migration or a halt in the advance of the settlement. Changes in the political situation back on the continent, a lack of leadership, or there just isn't any desire to take under any new land under cultivation. There are lots of reasons why this could have happened. And again, the archaeological record doesn't really support an idea of large-scale military activity at this time. We don't have 12 battlefields to go with Gildas's 12 battles. So I think we need to keep an open mind about Arthur. We don't know if he really existed or if he did, if he was actually called Arthur. But I think there are two things we need to take away from this story. The first is that the story of the leader that Gildas describes does capture a real phenomenon. Because, of course, Arthur ultimately dies, and the British retreat, and the Germanic settlers do advance. And whether this is due to assimilation or to military defeat, it's undeniable that the area under Germanic control does expand. So think about the poignant part of the Arthur story. Think about the idea of it being one brief shining moment that's going to fade into darkness. That idea is there from the very beginning. The second important point, of course, is that we are well on our way to a legend. The story of Arthur has quite a future, and we're going to follow the growth of that legend in subsequent lectures. But in our next lecture, we're going to turn to some kings that we do know something about. We're going to look at the origins of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
Lecture 3, The Early Anglo-Saxon Kingdoms.
Welcome back. Last time we looked at Roman Britain, and we saw how the Roman province fell to invaders or settlers from the northwest of Europe. And we talked about the resistance to settlement that may or may not have been centered around a figure named Arthur, who becomes the kernel of the King Arthur legend. Today, we're going to shift our focus from the British, the people who resist the settlers, to the settlers themselves, because ultimately, King Arthur lost and the settlers won. So in this lecture, we're going to meet the people who settled Britain and transformed it, slowly but surely, into England. So we're going to look at the societies these people came from, what they may have brought with them to Britain, and then we'll look at how these settlers created a patchwork of kingdoms that covered all of southern and eastern Britain. So let's start by going back to the homelands of these settlers to see what sort of people they were. First of all, let me say a few words about where they came from. It's important to know that they came from lots of different places. They were all, broadly speaking, from what we would call Germanic areas, that is, places where the language spoken was some form of German. But this included some pretty far-flung areas. Some of the settlers came from what is now the Netherlands, especially Friesland. Some came from northern Germany, especially the North German Plain, the area now known as Saxony. And quite a few seem to have come from Scandinavia, from Denmark and southern Sweden. Most of these areas, of course, are close to the sea, so the people who came to Britain were probably pretty familiar with sea travel. So these groups aren't all from exactly the same place, but their cultures did share some broad similarities. For one thing, they were quite decentralized. If you like, they were stateless societies. They don't have powerful kings that are making policy. There's not a single order, okay, everybody, let's get up and invade Britain and settle there. These are small groups acting on their own initiative when it seems in their best interests to do so. And a lot of things about these societies follow on from this basic fact. There isn't a strong central leader. A very important and very distinctive aspect of these societies is their legal system, and the legal system very much reflects this idea that there isn't a strong central authority. It's quite different from, say, the Roman legal system. In Rome, you have laws decreed by the state, and there's a whole infrastructure of courts and advocates. Really, it's the state that is in charge of everything. In these Germanic societies, the law is really more of a self-help process. The system is set up so that everyone can basically enforce the law themselves. It's about regulating relationships between individuals, or really, between families. There isn't any state to get in between. The way it works is that everyone in society has assigned to them a monetary value called a weregild. The term weregild literally means man money. The were in weregild means man. Think of the word werewolf. A werewolf is a wolfman, a man wolf. So were is man and guild is money. So this weregild is based on various attributes that determine how valuable you are to society. What are you worth? And this can include your gender, whether you're a man or a woman, how old you are, how rich you are. So you might have a very high status man who has a weregild or a price that is 6 times that of a low status man. And you find these legal systems in all of the Germanic tribes in Europe. In some of these Germanic legal systems, women have a higher value when they reach childbearing age, because it was believed that that made them more valuable to society. So if you look at these weregilds, they can tell us a lot about the values of these societies. You can see that childbearing is clearly valued. You can actually put a price on it. Now, this price was used to determine how much someone would have to pay if they injured or killed you. You'd have to pay a proportion of the weregild for a minor injury, then a little bit more for a serious one, and you would have to pay the full amount of the weregild if you killed someone. And the laws could make some rather sophisticated distinctions. For example, they could take account of how serious a specific injury was likely to be, what kind of impact it would have on the victim. For example, the Frankish laws imposed different fines for cutting off different fingers, depending on how important the finger was. You have to pay twice as much for cutting off someone's bow finger, that's the finger they would use to draw back the bowstring, as you would for cutting off any of the others, because clearly if you can't draw back the bowstring, you're going to have a serious problem. So you have to pay twice as much for that. You have to pay most of all if you cut off the thumb, because of course the thumb is your most valuable finger. So that's a way of putting a fair price on the injury, taking the consequences of the injury into account. Now, what if somebody did worse than cut off your finger? What if you're not around anymore? What good does the weregild system do to you? Well, it might not help you very much, but it's going to help your family, because your family gets the payment. And the reason that your family gets the weregild payment is so that they don't go take revenge on the family of the person who killed you. Essentially, the weregild system is a way of trying to stop people from getting into tit-for-tat feuds. Whenever there's some episode of violence, you might have a feud breakout, and this system is to try to stop that. And we can guess, certainly, that violence is not exactly rare in these societies. But the key thing to note here is that the system is all about self-regulation. There isn't a state to enforce it. It all has to be worked out between the parties. But the lack of a state doesn't mean that these societies aren't very complicated. They're quite sophisticated social organisms. There's a lot of subtlety in their values. And if you look at some of these barbarian laws, you can see that they seem to understand a lot about human nature. For one thing, they can differentiate between crimes of opportunity and crimes of forethought. Obviously, we do this in the distinction with regard to murder and manslaughter. If you plan it in advance, it's murder. If it just sort of happens in the middle of a fight, it's sort of in hot blood, then that's manslaughter. And we punish murder more strictly than we do manslaughter, for example. But the Germanic law takes this a step farther. It can distinguish between planning and spontaneous action with regard to theft. According to these laws, it's worse if you plan to steal something than if you just take advantage of something that drops in your lap. And one of the best examples of this, it comes again from the Frankish law code, and I'll warn you, it's a little bit gruesome, but it does give you a sense of what sorts of things go on in this period. And this is the penalty for robbing a dead body. And the fine varies depending on whether you plan to do this in advance. The fine is 100 solidi, that's a Roman money unit. It's 100 solidi if you steal from the body before it's put in the ground, but it's double that. It's 200 solidi if you dig the body up to steal from it. Now, why would you steal from a body? Of course, that's because in this period, a lot of times people are being buried with very rich grave goods, with jewelry, valuable weapons, that sort of thing. So it was a contingency that you had to plan for. But I think that's a pretty sophisticated distinction to draw. You're going to punish the habitual criminal more harshly than the guy who just stumbles across a dead body and, oh, why don't I just take advantage of this opportunity? And he succumbs to temptation. So this is a complicated society. It doesn't have an elaborate government like the Roman Empire. It's not a very elaborate state, but still it makes these fine distinctions. And it's not a society of equals either. There is hierarchy in this society. There are people of high status and people of low status. Some people have more resources than others. They might have more land. They might have more treasure. They might be able to command the loyalty of more people. And those are the people who get the higher weregild. So society is organized vertically into high status and low status people. But as we've already seen, it's organized horizontally as well because it's organized by kin membership. Belonging to a family is all important. These are the people who are going to stick up for you. Now, this system certainly doesn't work perfectly. There are members of kin groups who don't do what they're supposed to do. Essentially, they were the black sheep of the early Germanic families. And we know this because some of the Germanic laws actually spell out ways, essentially, that you can kick somebody out of your family. Suppose you have a cousin, and your cousin is always getting into trouble. You don't want to keep paying weregilds for the people that he kills and injures. That gets expensive. So there's a way that you can declare this worthless cousin an outlaw. And that means that he is a member of no kin group. That means, officially speaking, he has nobody to stick up for him. And this would be a very scary proposition in this society. So it does work somewhat as a check on people's behavior. Interestingly, there's also an opposite procedure. There's a way for somebody to renounce their kin. So I guess families had their problems then as they do now. But the bottom line is that people's experience is pretty largely determined by their social status and by their kin group. These two factors are going to determine a lot about the options that they had open to them in life. So what kinds of things would people want to do? What are the values of these Germanic societies? One thing we need to make clear is we don't know a lot about what people below the level of the elite valued, because mostly what we have is poetry, and poetry is pretty much exclusively about the top level of society. The people at the top are the ones who paid the poets. But since the elite members of society do drive a lot of very important aspects of life, I think it's all right to give their values some attention. And the most obvious fact about them is that these people valued warfare. War is definitely the most prestigious activity you can engage in. It's the most lucrative. You amass treasure that way. You give treasure out to followers. You amass followers. You become a leader. And leaders who are successful in battle, they get poems written about them. Their names are remembered. Everything good happens to them. And this society very much seems to have valued reputation and people remembering them. Now, the ironic thing about this warrior ethos, that's what people call it, the ironic thing about the warrior ethos is that the vast majority of people in these societies really have nothing to do with it. Most of these Germanic people, the ones who come and settle in Britain, are essentially peaceful farmers. And in fact, they are pretty successful farmers. When these groups of settlers arrive in Britain, they sit right down and start farming. They bring some of their own crops and livestock with them. They seem to have been more focused for some reason on raising pigs than the British were. They like pigs more than the British. But they're also very ready to adopt some of the local practices that work well in Britain. They start farming, they start raising some of the crops that are grown in Britain. They start raising some of the livestock that are raised in Britain. And slowly but surely, they create a new landscape that is an amalgam of the farming methods of the British and the German settlers. Well, if a few of them are fighting, most of them are farming, there's one thing none of them are doing, and that is reading. These groups that settle in Britain are illiterate, and they are pagans. And that's actually quite important because it probably determines a lot about how the transition from Roman rule unfolds. The new settlers simply have no stake in preserving very much of the Romanized culture that they find in Britain. They don't get it. It's not important to them. And this is quite different from what happens on the continent. Most of the rest of the Roman Empire is conquered by barbarians who are, in fact, literate Christians. Lots of people don't realize that. You know, they imagine barbarian hordes rampaging everywhere. The barbarian hordes on the continent are Christians. Now, they're a special kind of Christians. They're a heretical sort of Christian called Arians, and that causes its own religious tensions. But still, they're not pagans, and they do place a value on Roman civilization, and they mostly try to preserve it. The settlers in Britain, on the other hand, really don't. And that's why Christianity in Britain is almost totally wiped out in the areas that the newcomers settle. Christianity survives mostly only in the fringe areas where the British concentrated, the places where they took refuge in the West. There you do have people who are highly educated, people like Gildas, whom we met in the last lecture. These are people who certainly speak British, but they also can write very complicated Latin. Gildas's Latin is quite complicated. We're going to talk a lot more about the religious situation in Britain in our next lecture, but for right now, it's just important to remember the new settlers are pagans, and they don't have any interest, at least for now, in adopting the religion of the British elite, which is Christianity. But, as I said last time, the rural people in Britain had probably always been pagans, so the assimilation between the two groups that I talked about last time probably doesn't involve very much of a clash over religion. It's two pagan groups intermingling with each other. So now we've met the Germanic settlers. We've seen they're very decentralized. They have their own laws that are designed to minimize conflict between kin groups. We've seen they're pagan and illiterate. What happens when they arrive in Britain? How does the process actually unfold? Here, we have an interesting clash between our written sources and our archaeological evidence, and it makes for a complicated picture. In fact, I've already given you the picture that most scholars find persuasive nowadays, and this is the one in which you have lots of little bands of settlers. They come to Britain basically on their own initiative, probably because they've heard that conditions there are favorable. But that's not at all the picture that we get from the best written source that we have about this period. And this is the Ecclesiastical History of the English People by our old friend Bede. It was Bede's description of the island of Britain that I used to start off the course in our first lecture. Bede gives us a very different story. He tells us that the newcomers came from the most formidable races of the Germans. That's what he calls them, Germans. And these three races were, according to Bede, the Saxons from northern Germany, the Jutes, maybe from Jutland and Denmark, and the Angles. And the Angles, Bede says, are from the territory in between the Saxons and the Jutes. Here are the Angles in the middle. Each of these three races, according to Bede, settles down in a different part of Britain and becomes the ancestors of the peoples of Bede's own day. Now remember, Bede is writing in the early 8th century about things that happened in the mid-5th century. So he is more remote in time from the events that he is talking about than we are from the American Revolution. By the 8th century, the newcomers have coalesced into various larger groupings or kingdoms, and we'll talk about that process in a moment. But what Bede seems to want to do here is to backdate that development, to project it back into the 5th century. He wants to see these large groupings that he's familiar with in his own time, he wants to see them present right at the start. He wants to make the period of migration and settlement a whole lot neater than it actually was. Lots of small autonomous groups coming to Britain on their own in dribs and drabs. That's not nearly as impressive as three big peoples all coming in one big wave of migration and setting up kingdoms right away. But Bede's story of how it all happened has been immensely influential, so I'm just going to lay it out briefly because it's what the English believed about themselves until really quite recently. This was the view that almost everybody accepted of how England was peopled. So, according to Bede, we have these three peoples. Where do they supposedly settle? The Saxons supposedly settle in southern England. They give rise to the kingdoms that we find in place later across southern England, the kingdoms of the West Saxons in Wessex, the South Saxons in Sussex, and the East Saxons in Essex. The Angles settle to the north of them. The kingdoms they give rise to are East Anglia, the kingdom of the East Angles, in what is now Norfolk and Suffolk, and Mercia, the kingdom of the Middle Angles, and Northumbria. Northumbria was the kingdom of the North Angles, and Northumbria got its name because it was north of the Humber River, hence Northumbria. So now we've got the Angles and the Saxons accounted for, and you can see they're settling in the area that becomes England, not in Wales and not even at this point in the southwest in Cornwall. Those areas are still held by the British. But I've left out the Jutes. The Jutes supposedly have to content themselves with the Isle of Wight and with the relatively small kingdom of Kent in the extreme southeast of Britain. But Kent is a very economically powerful kingdom. It's very close to the continent, the trading possibilities are extensive, so for the Jutes, that's got to be some consolation. This picture Bede paints, it's very attractive. It explains very well what the map looks like by maybe 600, explains it very well. At least, those are the most important kingdoms. But the kingdoms probably don't arise directly out of the Angles, Saxons, and Jutes. That's just a very convenient way of tidying up a very messy history. For one thing, East Anglia doesn't seem to have been the kingdom of the East Angles in the 6th century. It was probably ruled by a Scandinavian dynasty, not a German one. There's lots of diversity among the artifacts from this period, and that probably means that in East Anglia you've got a mixing of a lot of different peoples. So East Anglia is a composite kingdom. It's not a thoroughly Anglian one at all. We have an even bigger problem with the Jutes. The Jutes are always a problem. A lot of scholars don't believe in the Jutes. Bede says the Jutes come from the continent, but there just isn't very much evidence, archaeological evidence or any other kind, that there were any Jutes before they arrived in Britain. Nowadays, scholars think that the people who become known as the Jutes, the people who end up ruling Kent, really they only coalesce as a grouping, a social and political grouping, once they all find themselves together in close proximity in Kent under the influence of the Franks across the water in France. There's no way that there was a big group of Jutes that got on boats together and came over to Britain. They only became Jutes once they got there. Now, fortunately, there doesn't seem to be a huge problem with the Saxons, at least. The Saxons are a little bit more straightforward. But it's clear that they only acquired a sense that they were Saxons in the course of the 6th century. This idea of identity is only gradually forming. So, the picture of how the settlers get themselves organized into kingdoms, it doesn't match Bede exactly. The archaeologists are probably right, and Bede is probably wrong. It was small bands of settlers who came over in small groups, followed perhaps by their wives and children. They settled here, and the kingdoms arose later. The archaeology is very intriguing on this point. What you see in the cemeteries that have been excavated is, in the early period, quite a lot of diversity of artifacts. People are picking things from here and there. They have brooches of all different kinds. But over the course of the 6th century, you get much more regional uniformity. It looks as if people are starting to identify with certain cultural patterns on a regional basis, maybe an ethnic basis. Identities are forming. They don't exist fully formed when the settlers arrive in Britain. Now, maybe Bede gets this wrong simply because he doesn't know how it happened. That's very likely. But I also think that Bede has an agenda. He wants to make these kingdoms look a lot more well-established than they actually were. These are very traditional societies. The older something is, the farther back you can trace it, the more impressive it seems. So, if you can make these kingdoms date back to the 5th century, if, in effect, you can just transfer them wholesale from the continent and plop them down in Britain, then they're going to look more ancient and more formidable. So I think there's a little bit of that going on with Bede. But one big reason Bede's picture of how settlement worked has been so popular is that it's at least easy to understand. Now I've explained why there are a few problems with it, why there are some nuances that we should be keeping in mind. I'm going to go ahead and follow Bede, because once we get to about the year 600, he pretty much does have it right. We do have a pretty clear picture of what the political geography of England is from this point on, and I'm going to start calling it England now. I'm going to be also referring to the people who live in England as the Anglo-Saxons. They wouldn't have called themselves that, of course. That's really a modern term that scholars have invented to talk about the people who are supposedly descended from the Angles and the Saxons. Thank goodness they didn't try to add the Jutes onto the name. That would have gotten really cumbersome. So what do things look like about 600? What seems to have happened by this point is that kingdoms arose out of this initial mass of small settler groups. And it was probably, as you would expect, a rather messy process. Society slowly becomes more stratified. Some leaders are more successful than others. They're able to attract more followers. They're able to impose their will on more people. So by 600, you have a group of kingdoms that spreads across what is now England. And the dynasties that rule these kingdoms may have different origins, in some cases, from the people that they ruled. We're not talking about ethnic cohesion. This is all really sort of invented along the way. But you get a lot of dynastic genealogy and ideology forming in this period. All of these Germanic kings begin to claim descent from the pagan god Woden. And we have texts of these royal genealogies that claim this. They go back many generations until you get back to Woden. And basically, this is the pagan equivalent of tracing your descent back to Adam, like the series of begats in the Bible. It's something that kings did to give themselves legitimacy, because it looked impressive to be descended from the king of the gods. Really, these are probably mostly Johnny-come-latelys, people who have only been powerful for a very short time, and they're trying to give themselves this extra cloak of legitimacy. So, they're all related to Woden, these kings. Who are they? I'm going to simplify here. The traditional way to classify the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms is to group them in what historians call the Heptarchy, the rule of seven. Again, nobody calls them this at the time. This is a modern term, but it's a pretty useful one. I think we'll keep it. These are the seven largest, most powerful kingdoms, the ones you really need to know about. There are a few other smaller kingdoms, but they're less important, and we will not worry about them. These seven kingdoms do align pretty well with the classification given by Bede, so he's not wrong about 600 AD, he's just wrong about how we got there. So here are the kingdoms of the Heptarchy, and we've already met them. Northumbria in the north, Mercia in the West Midlands, East Anglia in the East Midlands. Those are the supposedly Angle kingdoms. Then there are the three Saxon kingdoms, Wessex in the southwest, Sussex on the south coast, Essex in the area to the east of London. And finally, there's Kent in the southeast, just across the English Channel from France. As I said, there are smaller kingdoms that came and went. Some of them got absorbed into larger ones. And in fact, Northumbria was a composite kingdom. It was made up of two kingdoms that merged, Deira in the south of Northumbria and Bernicia in the north of Northumbria. I know that's a bit confusing, and I wouldn't even go into it, but we're going to see in the next lecture that the fact that Northumbria is really two kingdoms that come together in one, that makes a big difference. So those are the basic contours of English geography by around 600. But the dynastic picture is very, very complicated. This is a very competitive atmosphere. I just mentioned that these kingdoms have emerged out of competition for status among all of the various English war leaders. That process doesn't just end when one family finds itself on top. For one thing, each ruling family often gets embroiled in all sorts of internal disputes. It's very rare for son to follow father peacefully on the throne. And we can follow some of the ins and outs of this process in a document called the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. This is a year-by-year history of England that we'll be talking a lot about in the lectures to come. What we see in the chronicle is a whole lot of succession disputes and quite a lot of violence. A lot of kings are killed by their rivals. Basically, English politics in the 7th century and even later, it's one big succession dispute. And this is probably one big reason why you don't get one kingdom absorbing all the others. There isn't any one kingdom that gets its act together long enough to do that. But one area in which the new English kingdoms do seem to have been completely successful is in wiping out virtually all trace of the people who lived in Britain before them. As I said earlier, the British fled or they assimilated with the newcomers. That doesn't mean that military conflict between the British and the Anglo-Saxons ends. Anglo-Saxon expansion is continuing throughout the 7th century. Slowly but surely, the Kingdom of Wessex extends its rule all the way to the southwest into the British-controlled territory of Devon and Somerset. Similarly, the Mercians make gains to the west at the expense of the Welsh. And the Northumbrians, they push north. They push so far north that they're up into territory that had been ruled by British dynasties up until then. And they go so far that they end up controlling essentially the area that is now lowland Scotland. And in fact, the dialect of English spoken in Scotland, it's known as Scots, that dialect of English is descended from that Northumbrian dialect. So the Anglo-Saxons are definitely still expanding. These new kingdoms are expanding. But still, they tend to come to a natural stopping point, more or less at the line that marks off the old division between the Roman civilian area and the Roman military area. They never get very far into Wales proper, for example. And the British who are pushed back into these remote areas, they sometimes give as good as they get. There are some very famous Welsh kings from this period, including a very renowned king known as Cadwallon. Cadwallon allies with a Mercian king, a king named Penda. They ally together, this Mercian king and this Welsh king, against King Edwin of Northumbria. And in 632, they go into battle against King Edwin, and they slay him. So the British, who have been driven into the mountainous, less hospitable regions of the island, they're still a force to be reckoned with. Now, one intriguing difference between the British and the Anglo-Saxons in 600, of course, is that the British are Christians, the Anglo-Saxons are pagans. The British are keeping the flame of Christianity alive on the fringes of the island. But they are not going to be the ones who convert the Anglo-Saxons to Christianity. We'll find out who did in our next lecture.
Lecture 4, The Conversion of the Anglo-Saxons.
Welcome back. Last time, we looked at the Germanic society that the English settlers brought with them from the continent to Britain, and we saw that it was a fairly sophisticated society with respect to its legal norms. At least, the system was pretty well set up to deal with the fact that these are societies without much of a state apparatus. Then, we watched kingdoms begin to coalesce over the course of the 6th century. Some war leaders are able to dominate others, and they build up strong networks of supporters, and they create kingdoms. And we saw the creation of these kingdoms across a territory that would become known as England, roughly divided into about 7 major kingdoms, and we call these the Anglo-Saxon Heptarchy. We also talked about the fact that these Anglo-Saxon settlers are pagans, and that was true throughout the period when these kingdoms are in the process of forming. But in today's lecture, we're going to see that change. England will convert to Christianity. The process of conversion in England took about a century, perhaps a little less. At the end of the 6th century, all the English kingdoms are pagan. By the end of the 7th century, they're all Christian. Now, I'm going to start with a few general remarks about conversion, and then I'm going to back up and say something about what the Anglo-Saxons believed before they converted. In other words, what are they converting from? Then I'm going to concentrate on the two most important parts of England for the conversion process, Kent in the southeast and Northumbria in the north. First, a few general words about conversion and how it works. There are two main points I want to make. The first is that conversion in England is largely a top-down process. One effect of the creation of the kingdoms is that kings in England have the clout to bring their whole kingdom with them if they decide to convert. If the king makes the move to accept the new religion, his followers are going to go along too, because peer pressure in the king's war band is very strong. There's not really any such thing as liberty of conscience in the 7th century. You go along with what your leader is doing. But the leader does have an interest in getting the consent of his followers first. He's going to want to make sure that a big move like converting to Christianity has some support. But this also meant that if the leader of a kingdom changes his mind about being a Christian, or if you get a new king coming to the throne who isn't a Christian, then the whole kingdom might go back to being pagan again. And historians call that relapsing into paganism. And that does happen in Anglo-Saxon England. For the first few generations, it's never quite clear whether a kingdom is going to stick with Christianity or not. It took a while for the Christian church to kind of get going on its own, to develop an infrastructure so that it can carry on regardless of what the king is doing. And by the time that happens, the kings have pretty much all decided to stick with Christianity anyway. So kings are vital to the process of conversion in England. The second main general point I want to make about conversion is that it's a multicultural enterprise. We're going to see that missionaries came to England from two main directions. They come from the continent via Rome, and they also come from Ireland. And each set of missionaries brings with them different cultural assumptions, different practices, and this is ultimately going to cause some conflict, and we're going to see that conflict unfold at the end of the lecture. But for now, let's go back and look at what the Anglo-Saxons believed before they converted. It's important to stress what I mentioned in the last lecture, namely that the Christianity of Roman Britain has virtually no impact on the Anglo-Saxon settlers. There are a few little traces here and there of Christianity surviving in the territory the Anglo-Saxons settle, but there are precious few. There's not a lot. There certainly aren't a lot of conversions to Christianity by the new settlers. That doesn't seem to happen at all. And the British church that survives on the margins, in the Celtic fringe, the areas in Wales and the southwest and the northwest, those areas, they make no effort to preach to the Anglo-Saxons. They see them as the barbarian enemy, and the British want nothing to do with them. So what do the Anglo-Saxons believe? Well, they seem to have worshipped a pantheon of gods, sort of like the Greek or Roman pantheon, a bunch of gods with different kinds of aspects and characteristics to them. The most important of these were Woden, the god of war. That's the one I mentioned that all of the kings in Anglo-Saxon England want to claim to be descended from. So you've got Woden. And the other really important god is Thor. Thor is the god of thunder. Now, if you want to show that you're a follower of Thor, you might want to wear an amulet with Thor's hammer on it. Thor's hammer is a very powerful symbol. We have lots of these amulets that have survived. It's kind of like wearing a crucifix. If you're a Christian, you wear a Thor's hammer, and everybody knows that you're a follower of Thor. We also know that there are festivals throughout the year to celebrate the gods. For example, our holiday, Easter, the name for our holiday, Easter, is from the Anglo-Saxon word for the month of April. In April, there was a festival to celebrate the goddess Eostre, and that's where we get Easter from. We also know that the gods were worshipped in specific places. They had temples, and one way we can tell this is by place names. A lot of English place names can be traced to the worship site of some god or other. There are at least 43 of these places in southern England that have survived in the map today, and there are probably others that have not survived. So what was one of these pagan worship sites like? Well, they had wooden buildings. Often they're quite large, and they might be designed for a whole tribe, or they might be just for the king. And they could be the center for worshiping more than one god. And we have a wonderful example of this. This is the temple of an early king of East Anglia, a guy named Radwald. And his temple was set up in a very interesting way. It was a huge round building. And all around the perimeter of the hall, there were little niches, sort of like chapels. And in these different niches, you could worship different gods. So you really do have kind of a pantheon effect. Now, the interesting thing about this king and this house of worship is what happens in the early 7th century when Radwald goes on a trip to Kent. He visits Kent, and he's in Kent just at the moment when Kent is converting to Christianity, and he gets intrigued, and he converts too. But then he goes back home to East Anglia, and he tells his wife what he's done, and she's not happy at all. "How can you abandon the gods of your ancestors?" she says. So Radwald compromises. He just adds one niche in his temple dedicated to the Christian god, sort of adds him into the mix. Now, this is obviously not exactly what the Christian missionaries had in mind. They would have preferred strict monotheism. But it gives you a sense of the kind of paganism the Anglo-Saxons practice. Like a lot of polytheists, they're fairly broad-minded. They're fine with this new god as long as you don't have to give up the old gods at the same time. So that's most of what we know about what the Anglo-Saxons believed and how they worshipped. And I think the important point to stress is that Anglo-Saxon paganism is a pretty vital going concern. There's a network of houses of worship. You've got a calendar organized around festivals that celebrate the gods. We have evidence that individuals are personally devoted to their gods. Now, what we have to do is explain how all of this is transformed in less than a century. The first official mission of the Christian Church to the Anglo-Saxons arrives in Kent in 597. And this is a very high-level delegation. It's sent directly by Pope Gregory the Great. And there's an interesting story about how Pope Gregory first got interested in converting the Anglo-Saxons. Why did the whole idea of doing this come onto his radar screen in the first place? Supposedly, one day, before he became pope, he came across some slaves from England in a Roman slave market. The slave trade is very important in Europe in this period. There would have been slave markets virtually everywhere. So Gregory comes across these slaves. He's struck by their fine complexions and beautiful hair. He probably hasn't seen that many blonde people in Italy, so they really do stand out. He asks where the men come from, and he's told they're from Britain, where everybody looks like they do. Then he asks if they're Christians or pagans. He's told they're pagans. And this makes Gregory sad, of course. Then he asks, what's the name of their people? And he's told that they are the Angli, the Angles. Gregory then makes a pun in Latin. He says the name Angli is appropriate because the men had such angelic faces. Angeli in Latin. Angli, Angeli. Then he asks what province they're from, and he's told Deira. Now, remember, that's one of the two kingdoms that makes up Northumbria. So now he makes another pun. Deira, Deira, that's how you spell it. Deira, that means from wrath in Latin. So Gregory says, great, they'll be rescued from the wrath of God by being converted to Christianity. So later, when he becomes pope, he decides he's going to send a mission to convert the Anglo-Saxons. Now, this is a wonderful story. The dramatic encounter of the future pope with the beautiful captives. The resolution to send a mission to rescue the bright foreigners from the darkness of sin. It's probably not true. But the English later liked to think it was. Who wouldn't want to tell a story like that? There were probably other factors, in fact, that led Pope Gregory to send a mission to England. And they had to be important, because this enterprise was a big and expensive one. The head of the delegation is the head of the Pope's own private monastery in Rome, a monk named Augustine. So he's the one who's going to be sent. And he goes with an extensive entourage. Why? Why all of this? Historians think that the Pope may have been trying to add a new territory to the papal column, a place that is very much under direct papal influence. And one reason for this may be because the late 6th century is a really difficult time for Italy. There are enemies around Rome. The Pope is under pressure from these enemies, particularly the Lombards, this barbarian tribe that's always pressing on Rome. And the Pope is probably looking for new allies abroad. So the English project probably seemed like a reasonable scheme. So Augustine sets off with the task of becoming the first bishop for the English. He travels with his companions through Gaul, and in 597 he crosses the English Channel, and he arrives in Kent at the city of Canterbury, and that's where he sets up his mission. And for that reason, people usually call him Saint Augustine of Canterbury, to distinguish him from Augustine of Hippo, the famous church father who lived in the late 4th and early 5th centuries. So why Kent? Augustine has at least 7 Anglo-Saxon kingdoms to choose from. Why this one? Well, it has a lot to do with proximity. It's the closest kingdom. It's just across the channel. But that proximity means that Kent is very much under the influence of the Frankish kingdom in Gaul. We talked about how the Jutes become a kingdom under Frankish influence. And in fact, the queen of Kent is a Frankish princess, a woman named Bertha. She was the wife of the Kentish king Athelbert, and she had been merrily practicing Christianity at the Kentish court for 30 years with her husband's approval. This hadn't really made any impact on his religious beliefs, but it was an opening. The Kent people were at least familiar with Christianity. They knew what it was. They had trading contacts with the Franks. There were people that Queen Bertha had brought with her. She had chaplains. So Christianity is a known quantity. So Augustine shows up at the Kentish court, ready to preach the gospel. Now, at first, he gets a fairly skeptical reception. It takes a couple of years before he makes any headway. The king does give him rather grudging permission to found a monastery in the city. This monastery is later known as St. Augustine's Canterbury, after St. Augustine. But Augustine keeps hammering away, and after about 3 years, King Athelbert finally converts. And now Augustine is on a roll. He's got royal backing. So he founds 3 new episcopal sees. This means he has 3 other bishops to work with him. And he also manages to convert the nearby kingdom of Essex during this period. Now, one reason that Augustine has so much luck in this early phase is he and Pope Gregory come up with a pretty culturally sensitive way of proceeding. Augustine actually wrote to the Pope for advice. What do I do about the pagans? They have these worship sites. They like to go to them. Remember, we talked about how there were a lot of these, and they're very important to the local people. Pope Gregory gave Augustine some very astute advice. He said, go ahead. Use the holy sites that people are used to coming to. Turn them into churches. You're going to have to get rid of the idols, of course, but then reconsecrate the temples as churches. The people are going to feel less of a dramatic shift as they change over from one faith to another. And the Pope also said Augustine should just feel free to sort of retrofit the pagan festivals to make them Christian. For example, there was a feast on which the pagans in England sacrificed oxen to their gods. They would kill the oxen and then, of course, they would eat them. The Pope says, great, let them keep doing that, but just substitute some Christian holiday. That way all the good parts of the old faith will be kept. You still have the big oxen feast. Everybody's happy. Now, of course, this is very much the way that Christianity had proceeded in converting the pagans in the Roman Empire. The Christian celebration of Christmas owes a pretty big debt to the Roman holiday of Saturnalia. That had worked out pretty well. So the Pope's advice is field-tested, and it works very well in England. Plenty of people are able to see their way clear to adopting the new faith. And one very notable thing about the conversion of England is that you don't get any martyrdoms. And I think that's partly because the missionaries go about their work in this rather sensitive, rather conciliatory way. But remember, I said at the beginning that the king has a lot to say about religious policy. Well, he has virtually everything to say about religious policy. King Athelbert dies in the year 616. Now, despite Augustine's best efforts, he had not managed to get Athelbert's sons to convert. They are still pagan. So when Athelbert dies, Kent relapses into paganism. And in fact, there's a wave of pagan reaction. It seems to have washed over all of southern England at this point. We aren't really sure of the religious status of some of these kingdoms. We're not really sure if they're pagan or Christian. If you look at East Anglia, for example, you've got King Radwald. He's the king I mentioned who's got the rather eclectic approach to religion. He's got all the chapels to the pagan gods with one little Christian niche. Now, if you look at the artifacts from this period, you see evidence of this rather ambiguous religious situation. And the best evidence, I think, for this comes from the spectacular discoveries at Sutton Hoo in East Anglia. This is a huge ship burial. You've got a giant ship, a whole ship, buried intact in the ground, and it's got all sorts of grave goods included. Now, this may have been the grave of King Radwald. Nobody knows for sure. Scholars are still arguing about who it is. But whoever he was probably a king because of the richness of the burial. And the interesting thing about the goods in his grave is that there were some Christian articles among them. And the most famous of these are the so-called Saulus and Paulus spoons. These are two silver spoons. One has the name Saulus engraved on it. One has the name Paulus. Now these, of course, are the names of the Apostle Paul before and after his conversion to Christianity. So could this be kind of a hint? Is this the burial of somebody who himself had converted to Christianity? Maybe. But there are some problems. It looks as if the two spoons don't come as a set. They're not made together at the same time. It might be just a coincidence that we find them together. Maybe they're not sending any sort of message. It's also a little bit worrisome that the spoons are found in a giant ship burial. A ship burial is about as pagan as you can get. Christians are not buried in ships in the ground, typically. But it does sound to me perhaps like our old eclectic friend Radwald. This is the sort of thing I think Radwald would do. At any rate, I think it's an indication that the situation, the religious situation, is in flux. So, despite this early success of Augustine's mission, we have a serious setback. But hope is not lost. Athelbert's sons had not converted, but his daughter had. And she had gone north to the court of Northumbria to marry King Edwin. And she brought with her a Christian chaplain named Paulinus. Now, King Edwin actually already knew Paulinus. He had spent a brief period in exile at the Kentish court. He had met Paulinus then. So he was ripe to come under the influence of his wife's chaplain. But Edwin does something very interesting at this point. Once he decides he wants to convert, he decides he doesn't want to convert to Christianity unless he has the approval of his warriors. I think he realized that they needed to be a united band. They couldn't be divided over the question of religion, and Edwin feels it's